You are now listening to the Hunter's Advantage Podcast. We preserve the history and sport of hunting through curious conversation and action-packed hunts, as well as offering you tips and strategy for more successful hunts. Welcome to Deer Science Month.
The goal of this series is to break down the science behind the different senses of a white-tailed deer to make us better hunters.
We're going to be talking to some of the best deer biologists across the country about topics like deer vision, smell, hearing, taste, and we'll even throw in cool topics like, does culling deer actually work? The difference between CWD and EHD, and we'll talk about some GPS collar research. So anything you want to know about deer science and biology, hopefully we're going to cover it in this series. Everybody, welcome back to the Hunter's Advantage Podcast. This is episode number 156. We are joined today by a very special guest for our Deer Science Month, Dr. Gino D'Angelo. Thank you for jumping on with us. I really appreciate you coming on.
Great to be on with you guys. Good to talk deer any day of the week.
Oh, of course. It's a great day. I know you said your semester is wrapping up, so that's probably even better. Even a better time to talk about deer. But so we're currently in a four-week series, and you're the closing week. We've had some great guests on so far. We've had Kip Adams on, Matt Ross, both from the NDA. We've had Dr. Bronson Strickland, and so we're very happy to wrap it up with you. But the topic we wanted to cover with you this week was deer sense of hearing, and like we talked about before the episode started rolling, maybe taste if we just get really crazy. But before we get into that, can you give us a brief background into maybe kind of your growing up hunting experience, your education, and then kind of how you ended up working for University of Georgia?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in the state of Pennsylvania, big deer hunting state. I said beer there also. It's a big beer state, of course.
Big beer drinking.
I grew up in coal country, so northeast Pennsylvania near Scranton. And where I lived, it was coal barrens. It was the waste of coal mining. And what was growing there was pioneer species like aspen, broom sedge, not a lot of great deer habitat. And so I spent a lot of time looking for deer. Sometimes it'd be 2 weeks before I'd see a deer. And so I was very inquisitive about deer, grew up in a hunting family. They would travel to northern Pennsylvania to hunt. And I couldn't wait till I was 12 years old to go ahead and tag along with them. So that hunting just fostered an interest in deer and spending a lot of time in the woods. I went to Penn State University for my undergraduate degree. And soon after arriving at Penn State, I was at the fence of the deer research facility, clamoring to get in. And I actually made contact with the manager, and he allowed me to volunteer there during my first year of school. And then he invited me to live at the facility. And so I lived inside of this 22-acre facility with 300-plus deer, living with them, raising fawns from the bottle, interacting with them daily, and getting involved in a lot of research there, as well as field studies that Penn State was conducting. And so what a wonderful opportunity that was to be surrounded by experts and deer. I went to University of Georgia, where I work today, UGA, for my graduate work. For my master's, I worked on deer movements relative to dog hunting in South Carolina, trying to hone that management to reduce deer vehicle collisions through hunting. And we also studied deer movements relative to breeding, so during the rut, as well as fawns are being born. So we found a lot of interesting things about how deer change their use of their home range during those different seasons. I stayed at UGA for my PhD work, and we'll talk about some of that work today. We studied deer hearing and vision, again, relative to deer vehicle collisions, trying to keep deer off of roadways to prevent them being hit by cars. I went on to work for U.S. Department of Agriculture, returning to my home state of Pennsylvania. I worked with a lot of populations of deer that were overabundant downtown Philadelphia, a lot of eastern Pennsylvania, working to help communities reduce their issues with deer through hunting, as well as sharpshooting and other methods, non-lethal methods. I spent some time in Minnesota as the deer project leader. So I conducted research and helped set the seasons and bag limits for deer in Minnesota. And then I got to return to my alma mater here at UGA, where I try to help foster that next class of biologists and researchers. And so I teach a variety of classes, and I've got a wonderful, I guess I'd call a stable of graduate students that work on interesting research to answer questions, mainly for state and federal agencies about how we can improve population management of deer. And so that's my little rant about where I've been.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know a lot of folks say that if you want to run something, just kind of do it for a profession. And I know you started as a deer hunter. Has your research, or you're doing deer pretty much 365 full time, has that run into your love of deer, or do you love it even more because of it?
Yeah, I love it even more. I have to separate somewhat, and that leads me to block out days on my calendar, kind of like we were talking about earlier, Christian. And I love to spend long days in the stand. Like if you're like in the stand for like 14 hours, a lot of the, maybe in the early morning, some of the work stuff creeps in, but by the end of the day, you're out there and you're in the elements. And I just still love to chase deer. I bass fish, I rabbit hunt. I've got a kennel of beagles, but nothing drives me like deer hunting. Everything else is just to pass the time until I can get out deer hunting again. You know, just my mind's always thinking about deer and that next, you know, that next challenge, whatever it may be.
Yeah, I think we're in good company then, because that's exactly how we are. Turkey hunting is a bridge to get to deer season. Something
it's a good way to scout. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. With you being a big deer hunter and stuff, how many times would you say, if you were to guess, each year do you get busted by a deer's sense of hearing?
Oh, yeah. You know, all the time. You know, we've all walked in the dark, or you're in the stand, you start to lose some of your faculties about where you're at and what you're actually supposed to be doing there, and you drop something. And that hearing, I was astonished last bow season, actually. It was like probably 250 yards away, I think. I had sneezed or coughed or something. I really thought I had muffled it, and this doe just starts snorting. And I don't think she saw or no, she was, you know, she wasn't downwind. It's like, these things are crazy. You know, they're like space aliens. But I wish I could always apply our science to improve my deer hunting. But as much as I try, I'm still learning every day like everybody else.
That's hilarious. I can think of many times just this past season, that muffled cough in the morning. I'm like, it's got to come out, but it's hurting that I can't get it out. And you just hear in the distance, almost like an echo. You're like, oh, what a good way to start the morning. We have been going through this series, and we have learned from people like Kip Bronson, you, Matt, the deer have this beautiful trifecta for keeping them alive, right? There's these senses of hearing, smell, and sight, and you kind of put those all together and they get pretty hard to kill. Where would you rank each one of those senses in order of importance that deer use them to survive? Like, which one would be first, second, and third?
Oh gosh, you're putting me on the spot, and plus these tough acts to follow. Who knows what Kip might have said, you know, relative to that. I do think I'm gonna jump to my go-to is, like, it's a security system. I mean, you know, it's like Mission Impossible. There's lasers, you know, there's sound pressure devices. And that's what the deer is. They're their own security system. I personally think their sense of smell is number one. I mean, because they can survey a vast area just through their sense of smell, not only to avoid predators and danger, but also, you know, look for potential mates or to find their young, et cetera. And I think smell is what drives them to have a sense of security, whether they're bedded or feeding. At least they know they've got a certain, if the wind is blowing in their favor, they've got a certain area covered through their sense of smell. And I think next would be vision, and lastly, hearing. So I guess maybe you picked me to talk about hearing today, because maybe it's number three on the rung. But I think that hearing incites their curiosity, but their other senses are kind of confirmatory. Like, okay, I heard something that might be off. Could have been turkeys, could have been a squirrel, could have been a hunter, but I'm not really sure, because I just heard that one little bit of stimuli, and now I've got to confirm with my other senses. And they may use their hearing to at least locate where to train their other senses. But I think it's, unless it's something really overt, you know, I mean, like a gunshot, like metal, things that are extremely foreign, hearing isn't the defined, you know, I've got to run, I've got to flee for cover, versus if it's something visual that is clearly in predatory form or a very foreign scent or something that they've got a lot of bad experience with, they're going to go ahead and trip that security system and flee for cover, flee for the hills. But hearing, I think, is more of that curiosity.
Yeah. It's interesting to me how they always, it's almost like an order of operation. Like if you bang something on the stand, you see that ear start to rotate and look, and then their eyes follow. And then if they can't confirm with that, they're like, no problem. And then they start circling downwind. And you're like, how am I going to beat these things? It's like that they're really, really good at that stuff. Their order of operations, I feel like it's very hard to beat all three.
Yeah. Once they know you're on in the world, they're going to figure you out. They're going to try.
Well, before we dive too deep into this, is there something about hearing that a lot of people kind of, I guess a lot of people misunderstand, but you wish would be more common knowledge?
I think what a lot of us forget about is this pivoting ear, you know, the pinna is what we call the ear, the external ear. And look at our sad little ear. I can't pivot mine, right? But an animal that can train their ears in different directions, I mean, what an advantage, these big satellite dishes. But we look at deer all the time. We look at our mounts, you know, we think about the big brown-eyed, big-eared deer, but a lot of people forget just what an advantage it is for them to be able to shift their ears and actually localize the source of sounds.
So one of the things we've been doing throughout the series is trying to like put all this information in relative human terms, stuff that a monkey like Jake and I could understand. So if you had to put it in just that way, just how good can a deer hear? And if could you put that in relation to how well you or I could hear?
Yeah, absolutely. And once we dive deeper, we'll talk about how we figure some of these things out and how we can define deer hearing relative to humans. But it's actually quite similar. So the range, we've got a range of frequencies and, you know, different pitches of sound, which we can talk about some more. But across that range from low frequencies like a bass drum to really high frequencies like high-pitched soprano singing, deer and humans hear across a very similar range. Now, we think deer can hear more to the ultrasonic beyond what humans can hear in the higher frequencies, the higher pitched stuff. But it's really similar across that range. And their best sensitivity, so the sounds that they can hear best, are really similar to what we humans can hear. So if we were to graph it, humans and deer look really similar in terms of the level of loudness that a sound needs to be, what frequencies of sound they can hear. But I think deer have that advantage being able to localize sounds, being able to move their ears. And we have some good indications from our research and some other recent research that deer can hear those higher frequency sounds, those high-pitched sounds, better than humans.
That's okay, interesting. So basically like if you hit your release off of your climbing stand or something like that, they pick up on that better than, I guess, a big loud thunk if you accidentally drop something.
Yeah, I would say something like a ping, like your release off the stand would definitely be, they would have more sensitivity to that. Those higher frequency sounds don't travel as far, but likely if that deer is in your visual field, they're probably going to pick up on that ping pretty well.
Can you talk about the system as a whole? Like I know we were talking about the deer sense of smell with Kip, and he was talking about the elongated snout and kind of how they process, you know, chemicals and smells just a little bit different. We have this short little nose right here. Also, we're not using it to survive and get away from predators, so it makes sense. Is there anything different about a deer's ear system than a human's besides the shape of the ear and kind of how their ability to like pivot around on it?
Yeah, not so much. The internal anatomy is really standard compared to most mammals. Now, we don't have great, you know, landscape mapping of the deer brain. We know that they've got a smaller brain that's less complex. What we did was we studied brain waves relative to sound. And, you know, those brain waves look really similar to human responses in terms of human brain waves in response to sound. So I don't know the internal anatomy in terms of extreme intricacy, but the broad anatomy of the deer brain and their auditory system, so the actual bones and architecture of their ear, is really similar to humans until we get to that big external ear. And so internally, really similar, and that corresponds pretty well with them being able to detect the same frequencies and loudness of sound that we can.
So for like an example of like a mule deer and a whitetail, would a mule deer be able to pick up those sounds better because they have bigger ears?
Yeah, we would assume so. Like, so you've seen like on the sidelines of a football game, right? People that are, their job is to hold that dish with the microphone, and someone actually further away from the action would have a bigger dish, and closer to the action would have a smaller dish. And think about where mule deer, I know you guys, or at least Christian's going to go mule deer hunting this year. What are the habitats? They tend to be more open. The detection of danger from a distance is probably more important for mule deer. And so, yeah, I would assume based on their anatomy that mule deer are designed to hear those sounds from further away.
Can we talk about the external of the ear, the rotation? What exactly is going on there? Because it always freaks me out as a bow hunter when, you know, I got a little bit of tension on my string and it's fixing to come back and I just start seeing this right here coming.
Yeah, so I mean, I think your listeners can handle it, but like next time you kill a deer, right, cut that ear off right at the base of the head and study it for yourselves. And what you get is a lot of cartilage, dense cartilage. It's really similar to ours, but that base of the ear for a deer is a little bit more hardy. But once you remove that actual external ear, it looks very similar to our ear canal. And so there's just a series of ligaments that are allowing that ear to pivot, and musculature associated with those ligaments. And so that deer is able to crane its ears. So it heard a sound, it smelled a scent, it's not sure where it's from, and they're able to move those ears in different directions and biangulate the source of the sound. And so like if maybe Jake and Christian were hunting and you're on opposite ridges, maybe you're using white hankies to communicate with each other, or you know, you're scouting and you're using your phones to talk with each other and you're saying, I can see a deer in the distance, and you both got compass bearings from your different ridges, or used your whatever your favorite mapping app is. I don't know what Hunter's Advantage mapping app is, but you could triangulate or biangulate depending on how many folks you have out there. Say this animal's at this location from these two ridges, and so just like Christian, Jake on those two different ridges, these ears are saying this sound from this direction from this ear was in that direction. I heard it on this left side from this direction. And the brain's able to integrate that information to say, essentially, we have bearings on this source of the sound. We can train now our other senses in that location. And to take a step back, like we don't have really good information from deer studies on localization of sound. I tried to do this for my PhD. I raised 12 fawns at my home. So I took them from our research facility and brought them home. My wife said, okay, I guess we have here. And we bottle raised them. And they helped us learn more about deer vision, but they didn't want to perform very well on the hearing side of things. But what I wanted to do, and I could never train them to do it, was to enter a booth and look forward, and we provided a source of sound from an array of speakers around them, for them to use their ears and show us how they localize sound and how well they were at localizing sound versus other species. Because some other studies have been able to do this, like owls are a really good subject for this sort of research. you can Google owl hearing localization, sound localization, and you can see pictures of them. And owls have different ears. Their ears are actually offset. One's more trained for vertical sound localization, one is more horizontal, and their brain integrates that information. And so an owl sitting on one goalpost of a football field can tell that a mouse is within a 5-foot area field on the other side of the football field of the goalpost. So imagine, just from hearing, I know that mouse is within 5 feet, and I'm going to fly to it. And while I'm flying, I'm going to integrate more information and pounce on that prey. And so we couldn't get there with deer, but we know, because their external ears pivot, we know they have similar hearing abilities to us, that it has to be enhanced beyond humans. We know that their localization abilities are better. How do we localize sound? We turn our ears, like my hearing has, from too much shooting with poor ear protection, my hearing has suffered over the years. And so, like, in conversation, I tend to turn my head because one of my ears, I don't even remember which one, works a little bit better. Or if I'm in the woods and, you know, I'm looking around quite a bit, but I'm also moving my head to get, but I'm turning my head to see if I can get a better angle on a certain sound that I heard. And my brain is integrating that information. Like, when he turned his head to the right, he got information from these degrees around him, and I'm going to integrate that information. So instead of being able to turn our ears, we hunters, we lower level predators, turn our head to get sound from different directions and allow our brain to integrate that information. A deer doesn't need to turn its head to do that.
I got you. So kind of like with deer vision, I forget who we had talking on that, but Matt, yeah, Matt Ross, he was saying that deer vision, they have like a certain level that they primarily focus on. Is that kind of the same situation with deer, where maybe if it's like certain, I'm an idiot when it comes to like sound waves and crap like that. Like, I know nothing. Similarity to that, how, you know, a deer can only see like just probably mid range. And then, you know, because they don't have very many predators coming from the sky. Is it kind of the same with the deer ears, just kind of how they're adjusted and how they sit on the animal's head and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at them, first of all, they pivot their head. They've got a craning neck, right? Now they can move their ears, and it's not just horizontally or laterally. They can move them vertically as well.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, there's not much. So versus vision, where it's like 300 degrees around them, the deer ear can cover, and the craning of their neck and head can cover the full spectrum. And I was talking about our friends, the owls, and essentially, like, there's this globe around them, and you know owls can turn their head very well too, right? They don't have these external pivoting ears, but they can turn their head very well. And so they've got the whole globe covered, if you will. And our friends, the deer, look like they can probably do that pretty well just by pivoting their ears, head, and neck.
So there could be a situation where a deer walks underneath you and your stand creaks a little bit, and that ear could actually pivot up to hear.
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, that's creepy. That's
watching, you know, a deer that you're not gonna kill, or a deer that maybe you've gotten some video of, just take a different look at it from a different perspective and just watch what they can do.
That, yeah, I'm gonna, after this series, I'm definitely gonna look at deer with a more critical eye when they're walking by me. I'm gonna be studying them. Might cost me a shot opportunity, but I'm going to.
Speaking while someone's like in a stand and it's stand creaks or whatever, what about if when the bow goes off? Because we always hear those stories about the deer, you know, jumping the string or ducking the air or something like that. Is that, I mean, it would obviously have to be true, because if you ever stood down, I guess, down range of a bow, you know, like around a corner of a house or something, and the target's kind of near, you can hear the bow go off and the arrow fly through the air. Like, how much of that can a deer hear, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think a lot of it. So, I mean, think about, you know, first of all, your bow's releasing all that energy, right? The limbs are snapping, and then the arrow is actually almost flapping. You've got your turning of fletchings. And all of that is moving air molecules. And so that's what sound is this movement, this oscillation of air molecules. And so it's kind of like if you took, you know, flapped your wings, you can move those air molecules and there's sound associated with it as those molecules bang into each other. And so that bow, those limbs slapping the air molecules is sending a wave, that arrow is sending a wave. Obviously, your movement is sending a wave. And much of that is well within the hearing range of deer. And by the way, maybe you guys can shoot 90 yards. I don't with my bow. It's all pretty close too. And so those air molecules are boom, 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 just moving toward that deer rapidly.
That's interesting. I always thought there's no way they can hear this and duck until we did stand about 70 yards downrange on the corner of a house. And not only do you hear that string and the arrow come off the bow, you hear the whole way until it hits. And I'm like, heck, I can't duck that because I'm not athletic, but these deer definitely could.
Yeah, I mean, if you slow down, I shoot a longbow like for fun sometimes. I tried to hunt with it a couple of years, but then I decided I wanted to kill some deer. But I still shoot the longbow for fun. I've got some of those flu arrows with the big old fletchings on them. You know, they're a couple inches. Boy, you can hear those puppies going through the air. But that's just an amplification of what normal veins and fletchings sound like. And there's certainly a lot of, as the everything impacts those air molecules, they're just pushing them down range.
So I wanted to talk about some of the studies that you guys have done. I know you did one about auditory brainstem testing in, I think it was 2006, you guys conducted that. Can you talk a little bit about that study and what you guys found about deer hearing based on it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take a step back. I want to ask you guys some questions.
Okay.
Have you ever, were you born in a hospital or were you born at home on the homestead?
Hospital, thankfully.
Hospital, yep.
All right, so you probably actually had auditory brainstem response as a newborn. In the United States, across the board, newborns are auditory brainstem responses used to assess the hearing of newborns before they go home to see if they have any hearing deficits at birth. And then, did you guys go to public school? Were you homeschooled or what?
Public school. Public, yeah. Couldn't afford private, so public.
Yeah, I was in public school too, so... Actually, my elementary school nurse, she smoked, so I'm not sure what a great technician she was in the health field. But every couple of years, she'd bring us in, and we'd do behavioral hearing tests. She'd sit you down, she'd slap some earphones on you, and then you'd hear different sounds in each ear cup. And she'd say, if you hear it in the left ear, raise your left hand. If you hear it in the right ear, raise your right hand, right? And so you'd hear... Beep, 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 all different tones of sound. You'd raise your hand like, I don't even know if I was raising my hand at the right time. She'd say, you're good, get out of here. Johnny's next, right? Mm-hmm. If you weren't good, you'd get a letter sent home. And so you've got the auditory brainstem response as a newborn. Likely Christian wasn't sitting there in the bassinet raising his hand to say that you heard a sound, right? So that's based on brain waves, auditory brainstem response versus what I described in elementary school, that's behavioral. You're actually able to participate. So I'll tell you from the get-go that those behavioral trials for hearing in humans across species, they're more sensitive. So we get better information about hearing abilities from those behavioral trials. But auditory brainstem response is really useful for humans as well as other animals that can't say what they're hearing. And so we wanted to know deer hearing range. I told you that raising the fawns didn't work out so well. So here at University of Georgia, we found an auditory researcher who worked mainly with humans, entirely with humans, and generally with people that had hearing deficits due to poor nutrition. So think about it, you got bones in your ear that ping together to transmit sound to a liquid medium. We won't get all into that, but it goes from air to your bones to liquid in your ear and eventually to your auditory nerve. And if you don't have adequate vitamin D in your diet from milk, for instance, or from the sun, the bones in your ear don't form properly, and there can be hearing deficits in people that have poor nutrition. So that's mainly what he studied. And I approached him and I said, we want to learn more about deer hearing, I should say. We're working on vision at the same time. Deer hearing. And we want to work with you. We want to use your facilities. And he's like, you can't bring deer into my office here on the campus. I said, we will move heaven and earth to do this research as long as you'll bring your expertise and equipment. And so we have a 6-acre captive deer research facility at UGA. And we built a soundproof booth at the facility. And we brought his equipment in and his expertise. And we immobilized deer and bring them into this soundproof booth. We would expose their hearing system to sound. So we had different speakers that would produce different frequencies of sound. And we put electrodes on their skin, just like we would in humans. And we could monitor their brain waves to see, is their brain responding to sounds? And so we could test sounds that likely they wouldn't hear and see that there'd be no concert in the brain waves. Once they did hear sounds that we knew were likely in their hearing range, and we repeated those sounds over time, we could see that the brain waves consistently responded to those sounds. And so that's how auditory brainstem response. It's an innate signal. The brain is keyed to sounds, the brainstem, the real primitive part of the brain. We expose the hearing system to sound, and then we watch those brain waves. And so across these frequencies of sound, we could expose the deer at different levels of loudness. So frequencies this pitch, again, low frequencies like a bass drum, high frequencies like a really high ping. Loudness of sound, obviously, you know, whispers are really quiet, so low sound pressure level, or really high sound pressure level like gunshots. And so we could, at each frequency, so say at the bass drum, really low sound pressure level, did the deer's brain respond to it? At a really high loudness, did they respond to it? At what point did they no longer respond to it along this scale? Then we go to the next frequency. So across this range of frequencies, every frequency we tested, from 20 hertz all the way up to 30,000 hertz, deer heard those sounds. That was the limitation of our researchers' equipment. We didn't have the money to buy equipment beyond those guys. But what that told us was...
Raise tuition then.
Yeah, right. The student tech, that's high enough. I hear about that all the time. So what we found was that where human hearing falls off at 20,000 hertz, deer kept going all the way up to 30,000 hertz. So they actually had like superhuman hearing, ultrasonic hearing. Those really high frequency sounds, they're like what bats use for echolocation. So bats emit these sounds that bounce off of objects and bounce back to them, and they can hear them. Think about bats, right? They've got big external ears that they can pivot as well. They've got elaborate nose leaves, and those sounds actually come off of those nose leaves. They've got really intricate noses as they emit these sounds. And so deer that don't use echolocation that we know of are using sounds that are similar to bats that use echolocation. That's really cool. How much further can they hear? Well, there was a study where after our work, somebody used two trained deer in behavioral studies to see how they could hear, two trained white-tailed deer. Those deer would drink from a water bowl. When a tone sounded, there would be the bowl would be electrified. So if they heard the tone and they didn't pull away from it, they would be shocked. And so over time, they learned to pull away when they heard the tone. That's some real motivation there. That's what I should have done with our farm. Right? What they found was the deer were hearing beyond 50,000 hertz. So really, really high frequencies that you and I can't hear. So that's how we define deer hearing. We know that if we could train deer, we'd probably get some better fine information, especially if we had a bigger sample than two deer. But again, what we heard was across the range of frequencies, deer heard very similar to humans in terms of what frequencies and the sensitivity of those frequencies. The sounds that they could hear best were those mid-range frequencies. So think about in 3,000 to 6,000 hertz doesn't mean much to most people, but it's similar to what we're speaking today. Our vocalizations, the human speech vocalizations, are in that mid-range of frequencies. And I got our audiologist, researcher, collaborator, allowed me to come into his facility and blow grunt calls. And what I found was I had like 10 grunt calls with me, and they all fell in that same range of like 3,000 to 6,000 hertz, which is in the same frequency range that deer are most sensitive to, which is really similar to our speaking. So when you guys are out and maybe you're filming each other hunting, watch that speech, you know, you grumbling back and forth about, you know, somebody moving too much. Those are the most sensitive sounds for deer to hear out in the woods, is those mid-range frequencies that are similar to our vocalizations.
So opening up little Debbie's is better than talking to your hunting partner.
I would say yes.
Okay. That's all I need to know.
High frequency sound open those, and those high frequency sounds don't travel as far. My dad, when I was 12 and I had to sit in the stand with him until I was 16 in Pennsylvania, is the regulation. He liked to eat popcorn balls. I don't know if people know.
Oh, God.
That's got all frequency of sound, and some of it's pretty low. You got the crinkle of the package. You got the crunch in the popcorn ball. We crack open sodas. We had a certain technique to open soda cans. So, but you got to have fun in the stand too, right?
Right. Okay.
The Hunter's Advantage podcast is powered by Out on a Limb Manufacturing. Out on a Limb is a family-owned company based right here in Oklahoma that makes tree stands, saddle platforms, climbing sticks, and so much more.
Christian, I have a quick question.
What's that?
What bites down harder, a hippo or an alligator?
No idea.
It's a trick question. The Ridge Runner 2.0 bites harder than both of them. But all jokes aside, we use these products all across the land on public or private. These help us get into any tree we want and hunt where the deer actually are.
Most men go to the grocery store for their meat, but these products help you go to God's grocery store. I have used the Out on a Limb Ridge Runner 2.0 and the Shikar sticks for the last few years hunting public land bucks, and I've actually shot several bucks out of this setup. If you want to support the podcast and get some Out on a Limb equipment, make sure to go to outonalimbmfg.com and use code HNTA10 for 10% off at checkout. Once again, if you want to support the podcast, go to outonalimbmfg.com and use code HNTA10 at checkout for 10% off. Now let's get back to the podcast. Like noises that are super high frequency besides banging and releasing on a stand that hunters often do that you could talk about, or is it not really?
Well, I would say, like, you know, we're familiar with the grunt, snort, wheeze, right? When we get to the wheeze, now we can hear it, so it's not necessarily ultrasonic, but there are probably components of it that are ultrasonic. And think about that intimate encounter between, it's not intimate in a romantic way, it's intimate in terms of I'm going to kick your butt, right? When two bucks are kind of sidling each other and trying to intimidate each other. And from the scientific literature, we find that those high frequency sounds are really important in those kinds of encounters. For instance, in lab rats, when two males are fighting, the one that's losing will emit high frequency sounds. And it seems like he's saying, I'm tapping out. Okay, you got me. And maybe that saves face for him a little bit, because maybe it's only that male that he's fighting with can hear him, because those high frequency sounds don't travel really far. So his neighbor in the next cage might not hear him submitting to this fight. Versus low frequency sounds, again, they travel first. So think of the thud of a bass drum, right? Like maybe Jake's got a bro truck with a bass cannon in it, right? And he's thumping down the road. Those travel really far, right? Well, elephants use those low frequency sounds to communicate sometimes up to 30 miles. They travel really, really far. So, you know, when you're wearing your pack boots into the stand in the winter and you're thudding along, those low frequency sounds are traveling pretty far.
That made me think of the drumming of a turkey. Like, I don't have a trained ear for that, but it's some of my buddies are like, oh, I hear one drumming. And I'm like, I don't hear crap. But I guess they use that to communicate too.
And absolutely. And maybe that's you blow out your low frequencies from your bass cannon. But think about, you know, absolutely, those thuds are going further. Where I grew up, we had rough grouse, and they would beat their wings, right? And that low-frequency sound carries a long way to tell other males, I'm on my drumming log. I'm commanding this three-acre area right here, and you better not come near me because I'm big and bad, and I'm actually beating the air against my chest.
That's hilarious.
So where would footsteps fall in line with that? Now, obviously, you have probably the high frequency, like twig snap, but just for the fall setting, walking through leaves, is that kind of in their wheelhouse as well?
Yeah, I think, crackling the leaves would be in those moderate frequencies we're talking about, like very similar to vocalizations. And by the way, deer vocalizations are really similar to ours, and we can talk about a little science on that as well. But those footsteps, that low frequency sound carries further. Think about, you get busted by that big nanny doe, right? What does she do? She stomps her foot and she snorts. And so that foot stomp's carrying really far. That's carrying to the next doe family group. And there's, there's something going on over there. And she's snorting so that her immediate family group knows what's up. And actually, it's carrying pretty far parts of that as well, as we all know, right?
Oh, yeah.
But those little nares, her nostrils are pinching that sound as she snorts. And so it's a really high frequency versus like a grunt is made with a more open trachea and larynx, open mouth, and that grunt is lower frequency, carrying further saying, I'm dominant, I'm chasing this doe, and I'm going to command this situation.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I wanted to get into the vocalization stuff here in just a second, but I had one more question on the hearing stuff before we get into it. Natural versus non-natural sounds is one that I'm really curious about, because I have buddies that are completely okay driving the side-by-side to the stand, but when the second they get out, they're real quiet and whispering. I'm like, we just drove this massive vehicle to the stand and let everything within 50 acres know, but now we're being quiet. Like, while we're on there, we're not talking or anything. How good are deer at identifying natural versus non-natural sounds, and like what matters? I mean, if you have any anecdotal or research evidence.
Yeah, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? Like, we've all probably sat in the stand, and you hear that low frequency humming of an ATV or side by side, over the next hill. That carries a long way. And sometimes you're like, what is that? And then as it comes over the hill and you start to hear those higher frequency sounds as they get closer, right? Maybe the creaks, et cetera, associated with it. So certainly deer are hearing all that just like we are. But if you're driving the side by side, say it's your property, right? And you're out there every day and maybe you're doing habitat work. Maybe you live on a dairy farm and that's part of your normal routine. Well, that's normal for the deer to hear that, or the tractor or whatever it may be. But if it's only every Saturday morning at 5:30 in the morning that fires up and they hear the trailer tailgate drop and the side by side comes off, that's it. And somebody gets shot after that, a deer, right? That's a different story. Like in the neighborhood I used to live in, we had 10 acres I hunted on, and I'd watch those deer. Like, I had my kennel of beagles, they'd be howling and stuff, and the deer wouldn't pay any mind to it, because those deer grew up around those beagles. They'd hear my neighbor kids out on trampoline, squeak, 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 no mind to it. But if I did something or something else unusual in the woods, especially metal, or if my neighbor started to fly a drone and I got to see some deer relate to that, that was a new sound, because I knew that person just moved in and started flying drones, and those deer would act differently related to that. It's just like if you or I were sleeping in our bed and we heard, a hammer cock. Well, that's kind of unusual, isn't it? But if it's your air conditioning humming, you're used to it. It lulls you to sleep like a baby. So that's what I mean by it's all in the eyes of the beholder, and it's the beholder's experience. Like, what did you grow up with? And what are you experiencing day to day? Those are not unusual sounds. I'm not going to react to it. Or if I hear these dogs every day, but these dogs are off leash and they're coming to harass me every day, I'm going to react differently to that. Or if those dogs are moving like coyotes through the leaves or whatever it may be, I'm going to react differently to that.
So what about footsteps? Because deer hear, you know, squirrels running around and, you know, other deer. And then you got those possums that just seem to walk around like they have nothing going on for them. But how can they tell the difference between, you know, like a possum walking around and then like a human trampling through the woods?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's the cadence of the footsteps. Like, you know, I'd like to think that I've been pretty successful making turkey sounds with my 2 feet and moving, right? And maybe throwing in, you know, some yelps here and there, and deer are used to that. But, you know, if they're not used to, like, I've hunted in places where turkeys are not very common, and, you know, a lot of the time I don't sound like a turkey, by the way. I'm pretty heavy footed. Deer are acting differently. So I think that's different. I mean, you've watched deer feed. I know that you guys have. They're feeding and squirrels just buzz right by them. They don't even pay any mind to them. They may flick their ear, you know, they may train to it, but like, I know the intensity of that sound, you know, the lightness of the squirrel moving through the leaves, that is just, you know, the normal happenings around me.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. You hear people kind of like what you do with turkeys, like have that little squirrel call or something like that. They'll kind of like, you know, make two short little steps. And then, I don't even know what a squirrel call even looks like, but, yeah, it's just pretty cool because it seems like people go to the extreme sometimes, like kind of overdo it. And there's like a sense of overkill when really you can just take your time and maybe get out there a little bit earlier or something like that. But I don't know.
Yeah, I agree, especially in the dark. Like when if the wind's right headed to your stand and, you know, vision, you talk with Matt about vision. Deer obviously are visual superstars in a lot of ways. But if in the distance the deer hears something moving through the leaves, it's not going to bother to investigate. It knows where it is, even if it is a potential concern. I mean, you've probably seen even coyotes approach a deer. The deer knows where it's at. And it's like, you come, I'm going to stomp your 30-pound butt. You know, like, I know what you are, or I know where you are, and I feel more comfortable. And so if they're out in the field feeding and they happen to hear you 200 yards in the woods walking to your stand, I'm going to deal with it. I'm probably going to forget it after a while too, because it's not a threat to me immediately.
So let's pivot and talk about some of the vocalization research that you were alluding to earlier. What can you tell us about what you've studied about deer vocalizations, how they hear it, how they interpret it, all that stuff?
Yeah, well, it wasn't me besides my going in tooting some grunt calls in the lab, but there was some research in the 80s, well before me, working with Dr. Larry Marshington, a gentleman by the name of Thomas Atkinson, studied deer vocalizations in our captive research facility. And he had sound collection equipment and was able to, you know, get a full range, everything from the fawn bleat to grunts, bawls, whines is what he described, grunt, snort, wheezes. And just the quick take home on that is that well before we defined the deer hearing range, he was able to describe those vocalizations were in that like 3,000 to 6,000 hertz, moderate frequencies, where deer are most sensitive. Almost all the vocalizations, including the snort, fell in that realm, but they had characteristics that could have been also lower or higher frequency. So, you know, a snort has some lower undertones and some higher frequency tonality to it. So they describe the strongest signal from every vocalization was right in that sweet spot for deer, with a range of other frequencies associated depending on the sound. So even if a deer didn't hear all the elements of a snort necessarily, maybe they're really far away, some of the elements of the snort are in their sweet spot, that moderate range. So some of the elements are carrying further to the deer's ear. But reading their study, because again, it was before my time, and talking to Dr. Marchington about it, what I learned was that they didn't have sophisticated equipment. They couldn't study those high frequency sounds that we would consider ultrasonic, that we know deer can hear, but they didn't study those vocalizations with sophisticated equipment. So we don't know. We didn't replicate the study. We probably should. We haven't gotten around to it. But likely if we use some of today's, you know, really advanced sound analysis software and collection equipment, we'd be able to describe deer vocalizations to a closer T.
Do they have like a natural curiosity to vocalizations, or is there any way we can use maybe their ability to their precision that they have with their hearing system to locate things to maybe kill more of them? Is it like grunting or rattling? Like, how would you kind of go about that if you were teaching somebody?
Yeah, well, I think calling, you know, we've all used it, success or failure. We've done it wrong, right? And I think that there are a lot of successes to be had out there. I think some of the take homes are, we've talked about today how sensitive deer can be to different sounds. You've probably seen where you've called and the deer has no idea where you are in the world. In fact, you may believe that what they thought they heard was a deer sound and they still run from it. It depends on their hierarchy, where they stand in the hierarchy. Are they dominant, subordinate? Are they curious or not? What are their prior experiences? But I think starting soft as quietly as possible in terms of calling is an advantage because you can't go wrong. If a deer is close and you call softly, you can have some success. But if right out of the gate, you blare, you blast, you rattle really intensively, and that deer can look at you or they've already had a sense of you, you're gonna shoot yourself in the foot with that. So starting softly and building up. But I think, you know, I don't do a lot of rattling, to be honest with you. Most of the deer that I hunt on public lands, I know you can have success with it, but they're relatively sensitive. They've heard a lot of this stuff before. But I think if you were to do calling sequences, including rattling, integrating grunting, you've got your high frequencies, you've got some of your moderate frequencies, stomping. So, you know, both with your feet or with the antlers, you can integrate those low frequencies of sound that are going to travel further. And I would challenge you guys, maybe you guys do some rattling yourselves in the off season. You got plenty of time. It's just about June, right? You got a couple months to practice. Go out in the yard, go out even where you hunt and do some sequences and find how far can you hear each other calling. And what you'll find is it's probably not as far as you think it is. So start softly and build up and get really loud if you think you're not risking spooking deer because you can see far, you know they're not there. Try to draw those deer from further away. Another UGA researcher, Dr. Mickey Hellickson, who does a lot of management in Texas, he did some research on rattling, and he wrote about it in the QDMA magazine Quality Whitetails. And what he found was that he drew more bucks to him with louder sequences of rattling. And so that says a lot. You know, he worked on ranches that had a lot of bucks with a lot of dominance hierarchy, and he's trying to kill mature age class bucks, and his greater successes came with louder rattling. And so I think that's a good take home, but building to that is what I would recommend.
One thing that's really interesting to me about the rattling and the vocalization stuff, and you see it a lot if you watch a lot of hunting content on YouTube, is just how like extremely accurate those deer are at locating where it is. Like there'll be a deer 150, 175 yards away. And if those hunters don't move and they're still, it's like I've seen deer almost step on people. Like they come like to the step where those things are. And that is so cool to me, like their accuracy of like knowing exactly where that came from.
Yeah, it's and similar to our friends the turkeys, right? You call, and then next thing, maybe, you know, you went across the field, you gave up on this spot, and you look across the field, and there's a tom standing right where you were. They're able to pinpoint. And think about a turkey, right? No external ears, those little pinholes, and how great their sense of hearing is. Now, imagine if we slapped some deer ears on a turkey. We'd probably never kill them, right? But I worked a lot with catching. For a lot of our research, we catch fawns as they're born. We put collars on them. We study their movements and their survival. And I've seen fawns just give the softest bleat. Like you wouldn't even recognize it as a sound hardly as you go to capture them. And we're quiet. And all that. Mom is there on you. in an instant. And she knows, like, and I'm talking about in fields where you can see a couple hundred yards away. And mom hears that, and she's on it, and she's there to defend her young. Luckily, white-tailed does don't attack, generally speaking. Some have been known to, but if it was Mama Moose, she would, you know, beat us into the ground.
That's funny. So I want to bring all this full circle and give people something really tangible that they can walk away with, and maybe some digestible tips when it comes to like deer hearing. So if you had to just give like three general tips, these are the three golden rules for beating a deer's sense of hearing in the woods when you're hunting, what would those three things be?
Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is where possible, like if you've got property that you manage, I love to have a nice clear path to get to my stand. So like if I can walk silently to my stand, or, you know, use the proper footwear to do so, I'm going to do that every time, because why excite their curiosity? Why let them know where I'm going to be? Secondly, using paths, obviously, like, you know, when it's moist, et cetera, sometimes you can't help it, and understand that the deer's interpretation of sound may not be the same as ours. So give yourself a break. You're going to make some sound in the woods. Secondly, I would say my old roommate used to call it outfitting. You know, deaden the sounds that you've got. If you're carrying your stand on your back and it's clinking metal all the way in, why? You had all year. There's no excuse, Jake. It's almost June. You got months. Whether it's rubberizing or, you know, felt, whatever it may be, better straps deaden that sound. Same thing, the creak on your rifle sling, the silencer, you know, silencing aids on your bow. We know you're going to make sound, just lessen it as much as possible. Try your clothing on. Like when you're sitting next to your honey on the couch, put your hunting jacket on and say, now, honey, when you get up to get some chips on your way back in, see if you can hear me crinkling my coat. Yeah, try things out well in advance of the season to reduce that sound. Put that coat in the freezer and then take it out and sit on the couch with your honey and see what the sound, how the sound differs. Because we all know that temperature changes sound qualities of fabric as well. I've seen that many times. It's like whatever it is, whatever piece of equipment, that dry bag that I've got in my bag, just in case it happens to rain, sounds a lot different when it's cold. And so outfit yourself, you know, work through those sounds well in advance. And the third piece would be is let yourself be heard if you want to be heard. If you're calling, again, start soft, build up, but let's get loud, people. Let's, you know, get that sound out there. You decided to make a sound in the woods. You're interrupting the natural flow of sound out there, so be heard.
Have you listened to any of the podcasts before? Trust me, it ain't going to hurt our feelings if you haven't.
No, I have, but it's been okay. Some time. I saw The Prince of Poaching is what I was.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For good or bad, right?
Yeah, well, what a good one to be introduced to.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know what you guys are talking about, though, exactly, so go ahead.
Well, so this is what we try to do with every guest, and it's just a cool little segment, I think. But what's that one encounter, whether that be a shot opportunity or just a regular occurrence or whatever it may be, where you had an opportunity to seal a deal, but it just didn't turn out? What's that one close but no cigar?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I had two just last year. you know, I can still see the sight picture, and it's like, you got a good rest. You know, it's all good. Why wait for that next opening? And yeah, just slipping through the opening on me. I don't know. It's what's called hesitating at the moment of truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything lined up and I second guessed myself. And I had two of those last year. And
big bucks or what?
Yeah. Big bucks from where I've come from. Yeah. So here's what I say to myself. You know what, Gino, you're pretty decent at putting yourself in front of deer. You're really good at putting other people in front of deer and letting them shoot them, right? That's always the way it goes. Just trust yourself. And, you know, you work hard all year to get yourself in that position, capitalize on those opportunities, and don't second guess yourself. And that's what drives us. I mean, like, I can't wait for the next opportunity, maybe on those bucks again, if they're alive. So, yeah.
I swear it's like the circle of life, though, because some years you'll have and you'll be like, you know, if a deer walks within 100 yards of me, it's dead. And then you have those where you literally couldn't buy one if you wanted to. And so I think it just comes and goes, because like the last year, that was I was put through the ringer. And then I just hope, I pray to God that next year it'll just change on me, because there ain't nothing else I can do.
Yeah, we got something to look forward to. I think that's what we're talking about.
You can only go up.
Yeah.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't ask you this question that we've been ending all of the episodes with. If you could, and I think I know your answer. I think it's been a pretty unanimous answer from every single one of the biologists that we've talked to. But if you could take away one deer sense forever that could help you kill more deer, which one would it be and why?
See, I don't know. Right now, I don't know what those folks said, but I know that I would do better if I took their vision away. I really do think so. I mean, I know I said number one's the sense of smell, but vision would be a whole different story. I actually got to interact with some deer that didn't have good vision, so I could see the advantages there. But I wouldn't take their vision away. I take their sense of smell away, so then I didn't have to worry about wind. Just make my life easier. I couldn't do it to a deer. I couldn't take their vision.
Yeah, that's been the unanimous answer. Everyone had said smell. Kip actually had a really interesting answer. He said, I would take away smell, but it would be very short-sighted of me, because we would kill a lot more deer, and then there wouldn't be as many to chase. And I was like, "Well, that's a great way to put it."
Yeah, you gotta leave some seed there, right?
Yeah. So we really appreciate you coming on and talking about hearing for over an hour. If people want to follow along with you, or maybe consume some of the research that you and the team have done, follow along with your stuff, where's the best place for them to do that?
Yeah, we're at ugadeerresearch.org. And so they can just Google UGA Deer Lab and find us and see. By the way, there's a whole team of people, you know, biologists and up-and-coming biologists and researchers. Our graduate students do the heavy lifting.
But you're the best hunter out of all of them, right?
Oh, yeah, I wish. Yeah, they give me a hard time. Absolutely. You know, the thing is, they sneak out. When the boss ain't looking, they're out there.
I get it.
But they don't enjoy it more than me. I enjoy it the most.
There you go. Well, cool. We really appreciate you coming on, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great time. Enjoyable talk with you guys, and now I'm excited for the season. We got way too long to wait.
I know.
Trail camera season, baby. Let's go.
Yeah, that's right. Get them out there.
So that was Deer Science Month.
I love Deer Science Month. I think we should do Deer Science Month every year.
Yeah, just talk to different people. It'd be hard to top this year, though.
It would. I don't know. We talked to some of the best folks that I know. I mean, every single podcast that I admire, seems like these folks have been on them, whether it's Bronson, Matt, Kip, or Gino. And Gino was a really good guest to finish off the series, because not only is he super smart and sharp, he's also a hardcore deer hunter, and he's funny. So I learned a lot about deer hearing, I can tell you that.
That's the thing, though, because like it was almost it wasn't a kick in the nuts, but it was like, I feel like the hearing aspect of it isn't like as intriguing as like the smell or the vision. You know what I mean? Because like, yeah, we kind of hear the same, but it's just like, oh, you know, it is what it is.
It kind of freaks me out. Not only the rotation, but the ability. The one thing that stood out to me the most was like the ability to pivot up. Like, I didn't know they could do that. Like, they walk underneath you up, and they're just, no.
That shows how close we get to deer.
Yeah. Well, you know, when they're that close, they're usually dead if I want them to be.
Okay, bud.
No, I mean, I hope people enjoy the series half as much as it was to meet some of these folks and get to talk with them and learn more about deer. I don't know if I come away more encouraged or more discouraged, because I learned now about all the intricate weapons they have against me. Whereas before, I was kind of ignorant and blissful.
So both for me, both. But with that being said, that makes me want to shoot him even more.
It's true.
Because it's like, you know, after you seal the deal, you're like, I just did that. They have all these little nooks and crannies and all these advantages against me. But us as hunters had the advantage.
That's right. Some would call that a hunter's advantage.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. Now, it does make me, this series does make me want to call more, like, and hunt on the ground more, because I'm like, okay, vision is on the ground more. Yeah, dude. Heck yeah.
No.
Their vision is not that great. You get downwind of them and they can hear.
Yeah, the vision isn't that great, but as soon as you go to start moving your bow up, done. Out of there.
I don't know. I shot a 60-incher on the ground in Kansas last year. Got me addicted. Should have been a 160.
Should have just moved to zero.
Carry the one. Yeah. I don't know. This is a really fun series. Hopefully, if you guys enjoyed it, make sure to comment, make sure to subscribe, make sure to leave us a rating and review. And let us know if you guys want to do this every year. I don't know what we're going to cover every year, but we could get as nuanced as people want. But we need to know what you guys want to hear. But that was Deer Science Month. You got anything else for him, Jake?
Jesus loves you.
We know that. Amen. We'll catch you guys in a new series, new episodes. We won't, we'll move on from the deer biology back to us two idiots. So welcome. Bye. Thank you guys so much for checking out the Hunter's Advantage podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcast, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen to the podcast. Thank you guys so much, and we'll see you in the next episode.